From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
A federal judge puts the kibosh on Florida's alligator Alcatraz, but the state plans to appeal that ruling as the facility's opponents gear up for battle.
And we intend to hold them accountable to these environmental laws.
Also this week, it seems a growing number of migrants are taking it upon themselves to leave the U.S. for good.
You want to get rid of immigrants that have no papers? You're on your right to do so. But I've seen a lot of racism. They treat people like garbage.
We'll also catch the controversy about a common consumer product that might soon be reclassified as a dangerous controlled substance. And we'll remember the Florida House Speaker who really wanted to be president of his beloved university. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Opponents of the Everglades detention site known as Alligator Alcatraz are claiming victory after a federal judge ordered the facility to begin shutting down. WUSF Steve Newborn reports environmentalists are gearing up to fight an appeal.
A federal judge issued a preliminary injunction to stop new construction at the site. It's built on an old training airport in the middle of the Everglades. The judge cited a lack of an environmental review, which is required by law. The state filed a notice of appeal and is likely to ask for a stay from the judge's order while the case winds through the courts. Elise Bennett is with the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the plaintiffs.
This so-called administration of law and order has been breaking the law every step of the way here, and we intend to hold them accountable to these environmental laws.
State officials say the center does not pose any threats to the environment. A second detention center, dubbed Deportation Depot, is being established at a shuttered state prison about 40 miles outside Jacksonville. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
Meanwhile, it appears more migrants are self-deporting, and it seems the reason isn't fear of lockup, but racism. We get that story from WLRN's Tim Padgett.
A growing number of undocumented migrants are making the decision this year to self-deport in the face of President Trump's sweeping and controversial immigration arrests. When you speak with them, many sound like Tino.
I love this country. I'm basically losing everything I built through the years. But we came to the conclusion that we're no longer welcome here.
Tino came to South Florida as a teenager almost 25 years ago. He was escaping the economic chaos and political violence tearing his native Argentina apart in those days. He applied for U.S. asylum, but 9/11 had just happened and U.S. immigration processing had all but ground to a halt. Tino was left in migratory limbo. Still, he found that if he stayed underground, under the official radar, he could build a life here.
So the idea was to do everything legal. But yeah, I wasn't expecting that. And I'd seen stories of people that have been here for 20 years without papers. And I got, no, whoa, that's crazy. And here I am.
Tino is a nickname. He asked us not to use his real name because, as he concedes, he's technically in the U.S. illegally. Even so, Tino is a successful, tax-paying business owner and family man in Broward County. He's law-abiding. He often helps the homeless. But legal residency still looks years off for him. So Tino has decided to beat the Trump administration to the deportation punch. In a few months, he, his wife, and their two U.S.-born children will leave the country before he's rounded up and detained.
You know, I'm like one stop sign, one traffic issue from being, you know, point to like a criminal. Even if my problems are solved tomorrow, I will still consider the move because I don't like the way Hispanic people is being treated. You want to get rid of immigrants that have no papers? You're on your right to do so. But I've seen a lot of racism. They treat people like garbage.
As we drank coffee at his business in Broward, I asked Tino, is his self-deportation in that sense a victory for the Trump administration?
No, they're winning in that part, but at the end they're going to lose because they're going to get rid of people that actually help the community. I mean, what's going to happen when you have to pay $25 for a pound of tomatoes because there's no one to pick them?
Tino's one consolation, his kids are U.S. citizens by birth, and his teenage son will stay here with a relative who has legal residence and finish high school. Another self-deporter WLRN spoke to, a Venezuelan migrant named Meliana, has her own U.S.-born child, a 2-year-old. Meliana took him with her to Spain this summer after she decided her own asylum application would not keep the Trump administration from deporting her. She came to Miami legally 2 years ago to escape Venezuela's brutal dictatorship and economic collapse. But her humanitarian parole has expired. And like Tino, she says the Trump administration's actions made her question the U.S.
No valía la xenofobia y tanto odio para quien se queda.
I would never take my children back to Venezuela, said Meliana, who asked us not to use her last name, but neither was it worth the xenophobia and hatred to try to keep them here. It was a danger to them. Meliana, who spoke to me from Madrid, said she feels no such hatred in Spain, a country that's being extra welcoming to immigrants. But Meliana points out Spain is being more immigrant tolerant in order to solve a problem the U.S. itself is facing. That is, a declining worker age population and a shortage of professionals like teachers. Meliana, who was a lawyer in Venezuela, was teaching Spanish to U.S. kids at a bilingual private school here before she lost her work permit and self-deported. It's a lamentable and devastating situation, Meliana said, not only for us personally, but for the U.S., which seems to have decided that immigration is criminal. It's not certain how many undocumented migrants in the U.S. have self-deported this year. The Trump administration, which insists that any migrant in the country illegally is technically a criminal, has offered $1,000 each and airfare to those who do self-deport. But both Tino and Meliana said they had no intention of taking Trump up on it.
Tuve una crisis de pánico ese día. Yo vomité, me desmayé, o sea...
The day I decided to self-deport, I had a panic attack, Meliana said. I threw up and I fainted. I had no desire to accept money from anyone who brought that on me. Meliana says her fellow teachers here set up a GoFundMe account to pay her airfare to Spain. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Coming up on Capitol Report, a relatively harmless energy boost or a dangerous substance? When it comes to 7-OH, it depends on who you ask.
It is a significant painkiller. It has been proven to be highly addictive and easily can be overdosed.
How hot has it been this summer? Hot enough to get some medical experts thinking.
I started thinking we have to look and see whether or not this is affecting pregnancy and births.
We'll meet the owner of a small-town Florida newspaper who is as much a worker bee as anyone else on his tiny staff.
I cover the county commission and the economic development, and then I do some writing as well.
And we'll attend a memorial in honor of a former state house speaker and university president who won the admiration and affection of nearly everyone he encountered.
He had a compass that pointed north for him, and he did not deviate.
Florida Attorney General James Utmeyer is using an emergency rule to classify concentrated 7-OH as a Schedule I controlled substance in Florida. The move comes as the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration is pursuing a national ban. Tristan Wood spoke to researchers and industry representatives about what 7-OH is and why some officials want to ban it.
7-OH, or 7-hydroxymitragynine, is a semi-synthetic compound extracted from kratom leaves. Kratom historically comes from Southeast Asia. In Thailand, it's common to chew leaves from the tree, and in Malaysia, many brew it into a tea.
Consumption patterns, to me, in the traditional sense, more resemble the way that we drink coffee.
That's Christopher McCurdy, a behavioral pharmacologist at the University of Florida that has been studying kratom for years. He says over the past several years, kratom has increased in popularity in both leaf and extract forms around the U.S. He says options are now available for customers looking for energizing effects at low doses and those who want a more opioid-like effect at higher doses. According to animal studies conducted by McCurdy and other UF researchers, he says certain compounds in kratom may also be useful for treating opioid addiction.
Mitragynine or mitragynine, the main alkaloid in the plant, and we've looked at that as a potential treatment for opioid use disorder and opioid withdrawals, and it works very well also to reduce withdrawal symptoms, much better than buprenorphine or methadone.
Kratom products are found in smoke shops around the state. Extracts containing mitragynine and other alkaloids put into drinks, shots, and gummies are legally purchasable. But those products aren't being targeted by the government bans, just 7-OH products. McCurdy says those products are fundamentally different. Over the past several years, the 7-OH marketed products have been produced with much higher 7-OH contents than kratom leaves, often without the other alkaloids in it, all pressed into a pill form. And McCurdy says those factors lead to some significant safety concerns.
The 7-OH products become a very different beast from two safety standpoints. One is that we don't really understand what's all in that product because it's been synthetically manipulated. And then two, we do know that 7-hydroxymitragynine is a pure opioid in its action, more similar to prescription opioids like morphine or oxycodone.
The similarity to opioids is what Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer focused on when announcing the ban last week.
It is chemically manipulated in a way where it's very dense, and actually, I'm told by medical experts, can be up to 13 times more potent than morphine. So it is a significant painkiller. It has been proven to be highly addictive and easily can be overdosed.
Supporters of 7-OH have resisted that characterization.
And they have no science to back that, but 7-OH is more addictive than opioids, right?
Paula Savchenko, an attorney representing 7-OH companies, says that there is not enough evidence of harmful effects to support scheduling it. An assessment by the FDA released this year concluded 7-OH has potential for abuse, and some animal studies have found it has some physical risks similar to taking opioids. But no human studies have been performed using isolated or purified 7-OH. Savchenko points out that reporting on deaths or adverse events with 7-OH have not been separated from kratom reporting, and says most negative outcomes have occurred when other substances were also in the person's system. She argues 7-OH has been used by people looking to kick opioid addiction.
You need to look at the numbers and the data and decide, is this really a threat to imminent harm because it's addictive, or is this helping people?
She says she does not think 7-OH should be scheduled, but instead regulated like other emerging products like hemp.
There should be requirements on what type of packaging, and you should have to have certificate, you know, COAs, and all the same requirements to keep the public safe in the way the products are manufactured and distributed.
Savchenko claims the push to ban the product at the state and federal level is being lobbied for by larger kratom companies.
7-hydroxy came into the market like 1 to 2 years ago and started taking up that market share from the kratom industry. The kratom industry did not like that, and they started lobbying the government to basically make 7-hydroxy look bad.
McCurdy does support the emergency ban for now, but he wants to see further study into 7-OH, which could be banned nationally if it is federally scheduled as a Schedule I drug.
It could be a very good painkiller. It could be a very good pharmaceutical down the road if it's tested and studied in the appropriate manner. But right now, it really is no different than having morphine available in smoke shops and gas stations. And we would not, I think, anyone say that morphine should be available at smoke shops or gas stations.
Other states are pursuing their own actions, but Florida is one of just two states that give their attorney general the power to issue an emergency rule to schedule a drug. I'm Tristan Wood.
Pregnant Floridians are some of the most vulnerable to the extreme heat we've been experiencing this summer. Experts say human-induced climate change is increasing the number of days pregnant women are at risk from the heat. WUSF's Jessica Mazaros, in conjunction with Climate Central, tells us what they can do to protect themselves and their babies.
43-year-old Christina Duarte is more than 6 months pregnant with her eighth child.
I have had four during the summertime. I don't know if it's my age or this heat, but it has never felt this hot to me.
Duarte has lived in Florida her whole life. She's from Miami, but moved to Lakeland about 5 years ago. Many cities across the state faced above average temperatures for July this year. Lakeland, for example, experienced its third warmest July at over 85 degrees on average, which is a couple degrees more than usual. Duarte shares what it feels like to be pregnant in this heat.
One of the first things I start feeling besides sweat is fatigue, heart palpitations.
And when she's dehydrated, there's a cramping, which resembles contractions.
Because your uterus is a muscle like any other, so it'll cramp up just like you would get a leg cramp.
Pretty much everyone I interviewed for this story emphasized hydration, hydration, hydration. It's not just the temperature in Florida. Humidity makes it feel even hotter.
And it carries additional risk.
Bruce Bacar delivered babies for nearly 30 years in California. He noticed some of his pregnant patients having contractions and threatening to deliver early on days which were particularly warm. But something really changed for Bacar in 2015 when he read a medical study on how climate change negatively affects children's health.
And that woke a lot of us up, and I started thinking we have to look and see whether or not this is affecting pregnancy and births.
He later took part in publishing a peer-reviewed article in 2020 on the birth impacts of a warming planet.
Pointing to a very, very clear association between heat and a couple of types of air pollution that are linked to the burning of fossil fuels and climate change, and preterm birth, low birth weight, and stillbirth.
The nonprofit Climate Central asked Bacar to review its recent report showing pregnancy heat risk days are rising. And he agreed with its findings, including how two-thirds of the extremely hot days in Florida are linked to climate change.
The take-home is to not think about this necessarily just as a big picture problem, but to remember the impact on individuals because it can be lifelong.
Lifelong issues which follow premature births include risk of death within the first year, serious neurological and respiratory problems in the first 5 years, and Bacar says there's evidence preemie babies can develop serious illnesses into adulthood, like heart disease. Although all pregnant people and their babies are vulnerable to the heat, there's a portion within that population who are even more at risk, the ones who can't escape the heat. Take outdoor workers. Guadalupe Lamas carried her first two children to term while picking produce in the fields.
When we were working, pregnancy was not an excuse.
Lamas is now a women's health nurse practitioner in Plant City, treating many migrant farm workers. She says it's hard and uncomfortable to work outside while pregnant, but you just accept it.
When I was doing it, I didn't know I could do something else, but then I had a sixth grade education, so that's what you did.
Another high-risk group is pregnant pedestrians. Kristan Magloire is a North Miami Beach OBGYN. Many of her patients walk to their doctor's appointments or wait at bus stops in the heat, and some can't even cool off at home.
In these areas, you have women who are living in homes that lack air conditioning. There may be a system, but it may not be working. And the cost of the repairs are very high. So they might go and say, you know, what is more important right now, me getting food on the table or getting to work or me just being cool?
The most common heat symptoms Magloire observes in her patients are lower abdominal pressure, back pain, and, like Christina Duarte experienced, cramping. She recommends drinking lots of water. If you walk outside, take breaks and try to stay off your feet. Magloire says we need a different approach to climate health action because she thinks the government isn't doing its part.
You have so many of these wonderful AI entrepreneurs and people in finance. You know, maybe we need to start approaching them and asking them to start creating foundations that are going to be targeting maternity care. I don't know, but something has to change.
As temperatures continue to rise, Magloire would like to see public health initiatives like cooling centers, heat action plans, and better access to health care. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
A small-town newspaper owner and publisher is featured in the latest Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast. Michael Kelly runs the Herald Advocate in the rural central town of Wauchula. It's been the pulse of the community for decades. Kelly shares what it's like to live and work in a tight-knit town where everyone knows your name and your business. He offers a look at the joys and struggles of small-town journalism. He discusses why print newspapers still matter and how they can adapt to survive in an increasingly online world. Here's an excerpt.
It's been in our family since 1941.
Wow.
I'm the third generation publisher now. We're in Hardy County, about 28,000 people. And we have a circulation of about 3,000 print customers and about 600 online subscribers.
Wow. And so they really do rely on you for everything from high school sports, I'd imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, basically, there needs to be a murder for us to get any outside coverage from any of the TV stations, or we hardly get any other newspapers ever come in and cover anything.
Yeah.
So we're kind of the only source of information for our entire county.
And how often do you publish?
Once a week on Thursdays.
Okay. And then are you updating online in between?
Yes. Then? If there's something that we feel like is worthy, we put it online immediately.
Now, I was looking on your website yesterday, and I thought I saw your byline on...
Yeah, I do. I cover the county commission and the economic development, and then I do some writing as well.
So you do... Jack of all trades. And then where do you guys actually print the paper?
We actually get printed down here by Adams Publishing.
Okay. Oh, I think they're the host of our convention here. All right. Well, you were telling me, you just mentioned briefly, you've got kind of a big news, not kind of, you definitely have a big news story there. Tell us a little bit about that.
There was a trial in January. We had a grandmother that got convicted for involuntary manslaughter, leaving her grandchild in the car for about 6 hours. And unfortunately, the little under 2-year-old child died.
Oh, wow. And what kind of reaction did the community have to that story?
There was a lot of support for her still. I know after the verdict was announced, she was sentenced to 5 years. She had a lot of supporters in the courtroom. And one lady stood up and said everything we had put in our paper was BS and none of it was true. But I think that most of the community rallied behind the parents that lost a child.
Sure. What's it like now? You know, I'm in Tallahassee. I work for a wire service. I do the podcast. So there's not a lot of people who I'm coming into contact with. I'm not going to lunch. And I will say I was in line in the drugstore not too long ago and somebody heard my voice and said, "Oh, are you the lady?" You know, so there is that, but it's not like living in a very small town and having, you know, go to the grocery store and people, what's that like?
I get run into contact with people all the time. I mean, I think it's important to be in the community. I hear some stuff that, you know, stuff's going on that would be leads to stories. And then I also run into people that are mad or happy about something we did, and they're more than willing to let me know a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine that you're probably a big part of the community.
Absolutely.
There. Do you think that print is going to go the way of the dinosaur, or do you think we'll still be reading hard copy newspapers?
I kind of think there'll still be a need for hard copy. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day that these moms nowadays, like when I was playing sports, I have a scrapbook of all my stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So do moms now have like a digital place where they're putting all that stuff? And I really don't know. I'd be interested to find that out.
Right.
But we have some people that will call our office and say, "Hey, I want a paper from 20 or 30 or 40 years ago when I got some award," and they want a
hard copy,
of it now. So
do you have that?
We have a single edition book in our office going back to about 1929. Some of the pages are so brittle that it's hard to even turn the page because the paper just breaks.
Oh, I would love to see
that. So we are able to.
Are you archiving that now?
We are archiving that now, yes. And we have it on microfilm going back to about the 50s. But those older books, we can open them and take a picture and send it to somebody.
That was Michael Kelly, owner and publisher of the Herald Advocate, in an excerpt from the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, family, friends, and community members honored the late House Speaker and FSU President John Thrasher during a recent memorial service. During his celebration of life, Thrasher was remembered for his legislative skills and his character. Margie Menzel reports.
He had a compass that pointed north for him, and he did not deviate.
Kathy Mears is Florida's Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture. When Thrasher was president of Florida State University, she worked in his legislative affairs office. She calls him a loving leader.
He didn't just change rules or laws or policies. He changed hearts and lives. And I think that is a much longer lasting legacy than just caring about policies.
But that doesn't mean Thrasher didn't get things done. Former Governor Jeb Bush gave Thrasher's eulogy during the memorial on FSU's campus.
He was the equivalent, a conservative equivalent of Lyndon Baines Johnson, probably the master of the legislative process at the national level. John Thrasher can certainly take that mantle here in Florida.
In his eulogy, Bush said he was running for his first term as governor just as Thrasher was running to become Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. They talked about what they would do.
His policy successes as Speaker became the building block for a generation of conservative governance. And whether you're a liberal or a conservative, that's not really the point. The point is there are moments in time where leadership comes to the forefront and can change the direction. And that's exactly what happened in 1999.
Around that same time, Doug Wiles served as the Democratic leader of the House. He says he was impressed by Thrasher's ability to work with anyone, adding that even when Thrasher became a powerful speaker, he would listen to the other side.
John felt like that the process of government is to get everyone's opinion. And I can tell you, in more than one case, you know, there were amendments to what was thought to be a pretty good bill on the floor that he took after a good debate, and they became a part of the bill. You know, that's just lacking today.
Wiles and Thrasher both represented Northeast Florida. Wiles says Thrasher worked hard to create a statewide conservative majority and even tried to get Wiles to switch parties. That didn't happen, but they collaborated well to represent their constituents. The old guard was there for Thrasher's celebration of life. They hung on the words of Jean Thrasher, his wife of 60 years, whom they all knew to have been crucial to his success in life. Standing on stage with her family, Jean didn't mince words about her husband's cancer diagnosis.
It took over our lives, all of us here. And we were determined. He was. He was determined. He was fearless. And I would say he was amazing. And our son, John, he called him a warrior. And our girls, our two girls, Jen and Julie, they both called him, what did they call him? Oh, that's right. They called him a lion.
Thrasher died in May at the age of 81. He's survived by Jean, their three children, and eight grandchildren. I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Newborn, Tim Padgett, Jessica Mazaros, and Derek Camp. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.